there are some new things happening in our midst. Dan Churchwell has been part of Christ Church with his family here, Julie and his four children, and so we're delighted to have them here. And Dan is working, has been a college professor in Washington State, and is now here working with Acton Institute locally. And his official position is Associate Director of Program Outreach at Acton Institute, this Grand Rapids-based think tank that we have here to promote a free and virtuous society characterized by individual liberty and sustained by religious principles. And so Dan has been a teacher at the Whitworth University and also the Moody Bible Institute branch in Washington, and is now has a lot of experience in the Fortune 100 logistics company, a commercial real estate investment firm, as well as serving as executive director of an international medical nonprofit. Married to Julie for 16 years, and we're delighted to have him come and talk to us this morning about kind of an entrepreneurial approach to missions and dealing with poor countries. For decades, we've been pouring money into the poor countries and developing countries of the world. It hasn't really produced a whole lot in terms of helping them become financially independent. And so there are maybe other ways to look at that. And so Dan's going to lead us in some thoughts on that, and then we're going to open it up to questions and discussion as we go along. So welcome to Dan Churchwell.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. And my wife and I moved to Grand Rapids, Michigan about a year and a half ago. We've been attending Christ Church since September of 16. So it is a pleasure to be invited by the Missions Committee and the leadership of Christ Church to come and present some of these ideas. A lot of work goes into an event that takes a month to execute. So thank you, Dan, and the Missions Committee, and for all of their hard work to make this happen. Let me tell you just briefly what I've been tasked to do is tell you just a little bit about the Acton Institute and what I do and what we do collectively as an institute. And then to share just a little bit, provocatively so maybe, to some, about where missions is heading, some definitions. The mark of a well-trained mind is the ability to make distinctions. And we're going to talk about a few distinctions that might be tension-filled a little bit about where missions is going, what it's like, etc. And then to open it up for questions. Well, we need to be a hard stop at 10:50, and I was a professor for a decade. So I'm used to having 16 weeks to unpack a topic. So we'll see if we can do this in the time we have left. Acton, the Acton Institute. How many of you had heard of the Acton Institute here in Grand Rapids? Oh, wow, okay. We're located at 98 East Fulton, right downtown. If you're coming down the Fulton Hill, we're the building with that glittery mural tacked onto it coming into downtown. We bought the building 4 years ago, renovated it, and it's a beautiful space. I've had the privilege of taking several of you through it. Anybody who ever wants a tour, see what a think tank does, it's not really that magical. I'd be happy to give you a tour of what we do. The Acton Institute is named after Lord Acton. He was a British Catholic historian, theologian, and politician who died in 1902. Some of you are probably familiar with his most famous quote. If you watch any kind of movie that deals with intrigue, this quote is probably prominently displayed. Power tends to corrupt, but absolute power corrupts absolutely. How many of you have heard that phrase or some engagement in that phrase? That is Lord Acton. And believe it or not, he's writing that in a letter to bishops decrying actions of the Pope. So that's the context of which that was written. So there's some interesting things just wrapped up there. But power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. One of my more favorite quotes that I use is, "Liberty is not the power of doing what we like, but the right of being able to do what we ought." And so as a politician, historian, and theologian, he was really interdisciplinary in trying to figure out how do we work with the state as people who believe in transcendence, in a God who rules the universe. And so that is our namesake. One of our taglines is the Acton Institute exists to help people connect good intentions to sound economics. Sometimes we have a lot of really good feelings about doing certain kinds of things, but once we implement the ideas, we find out they're laden with deleterious consequences. We don't think through our feelings and our actions to the point of saying, what will these ideas actually do once we implement them? So we exist to connect good intentions to sound economics. I want to dispel a myth. We are not a Catholic organization. We are ecumenical. We were started by a Catholic priest in 1990, so 28 years ago, almost to the day. We were founded here in Grand Rapids. Most think tanks exist in Washington, D.C., New York City, that space. It was founded here, but it was founded from day one as an ecumenical think tank. And so we have Protestants, Greek Orthodox, and Catholic theologians, social philosophers, economic professors, all stripes trying to think through what does it mean to live a virtuous life in our modern world. So that's what a think tank does. We have a research arm, a media arm, and a program arm. So we have researchers, they write books, they write op-eds, they're on Fox News, CNN, MSNBC, CNBC, etc. We also have a journal, a peer-reviewed journal called the Journal of Markets and Morality. It comes out twice a year. We have a media arm that produces world-class, world-leading documentaries. One of them that you might see, write this down, if you want to get a little sense of what we do, if you have Netflix or Amazon Prime, etc., you can see one of our world-class documentaries called Poverty, Inc., like Incorporated, I-N-C. Poverty, Inc. is a free download now on Netflix or Amazon, and it's won over 60 foreign film festival awards and the $100,000 Templeton Prize in documentary leadership. It's been shown at MIT, Harvard, Berkeley, UPenn, and a host of other colleges, dealing with the failure of the foreign aid market and the complexities of what it means to invest, for example, in the continent of Africa, $1.3 trillion over the past 60 years, and have almost nothing to show for it. And so these are tension-filled ideas, and so that's what we get to deal with every day. So we have a research arm, a media arm, and I'm the associate director of programs. We have a program and education arm. Last year, we did 70 programs nationally and internationally. I had the chance to travel from Anchorage to Miami, Los Angeles to New York City, Denver to Austin, to speak, engage, and think through with city leaders, philosophers, professors, practitioners on what to do with these issues in their cities. So that is the Acton Institute. Please talk to me if you want anything to know more about that. I'd be happy to engage with you. Now let's get to the topic at hand, entrepreneurial missions. So when you think about missions, for centuries, there was an idea of the Great Commission, going to all the world and preach the gospel, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, and go, and these missionaries. And there are different models of what it means to be a missionary. And if you think about the unprecedented economic growth that has happened in the last 200 to 250 years, there has been some transformation of what it looks like to do missions and to do missions well and virtuously. And one of the topics that a lot of people in the last 30 years, there's a phrase called BAM. How many of you have heard in the missions what BAM, business as mission? There's whole books, it's a whole cottage industry now. And over the last 30 years, does anybody know? Sorry, I'm a professor, I actually do ask questions. About 30 years ago, what major worldwide phenomenon was happening about roughly 30 years ago that caused business's mission to become a thing? Anybody know? Shout it out. I'm actually asking. Fall of communism. Boom, right here. Imaginary bonus points right here. You A on the first quiz. So you have the fall of communism and all these countries trying to figure out how to assimilate and create some sort of market economy coming out of centrally planned economies. And you know what a lot of Christians did immediately, emotively, and just out of the gate? We need to go and start into these countries. And many of them were still closed. So what did they do? They invented businesses on paper, lied on visa applications to get into these countries to share the gospel. Well, as soon as you get into these countries, what becomes very quickly apparent? Those of you who own businesses, work for businesses, have any kind of expertise, if you can't deliver on what you say you are going to do, you're quickly, what, run out of business. If you can't manufacture brakes for airplanes, nobody's going to buy those and put them on their airplane, right? Think whatever business model you're in, if you say you're an architect and you can't draw a straight line, they're not going to let you build their homes, their hospital, etc., right? And for about 5 or 6 years, there was a horrible stain on missions because of this kind of facade out of good intentions that irreparably damaged for over a decade what it meant to be a Christian working in a closed or recently opened nation. So let me give you a quick definition. So about 30 years ago, they're like, we got to think about this differently. What does it look like to honestly do good, virtuous missions in these countries? And that is when this conversation started. So we're about 3 decades in, which is a pretty short amount of time when it comes to the world, history, and theology of missions. But bam, business as mission is generally, the definition is a for-profit commercial business venture that is Christian-led, intentionally devoted to being used as an instrument of God's mission to the world and is operated in a cross-cultural environment, either domestic or international. And so what does it look like to create business for the glory of God with that as the front leading edge, but also deliver a solid product economically? So let's do a quick history lesson. Does anybody know what the hockey stick of human prosperity is referencing? The hockey stick. I know this is hockey country a little bit. Go Griffins, right?
It has something to do with graph.
Yeah, good. So economic historians, right, left, center, whatever you are, economic historians, if you look at the history of economic prosperity, it's just flatlined. Every now there's a little blip, bleep, for recorded history. I didn't bring any charts here because that's boring, right? Supply and demand curves, et cetera. But if you work with me here, a hockey stick that's turned upside down, it's straight, little blips, little tiny little blips, and roughly around 1800, precipitous rise in human prosperity up until today. So roughly 200, 250 years, give or take. It's a hockey stick. What issue was at hand roughly 1800? What was going on? The Industrial Revolution. Boom, man, you guys are firing on all cylinders. So you have the Industrial Revolution that up until roughly 1800, to put a round number on it, almost 100%, 95% of the world was living hand-to-mouth, subsistence living of some kind, either in cities or in farms. And you have this Industrial Revolution happen, machinery, global trade, the invention of insurance, so that people would fund ships. It wouldn't have to be kings or queens endowing ships to go find. It would be companies coming together and exploration. I mean, this radical time of transformation in history. You had this in history class, I'm sure. Well, economic historians call this the hockey stick of human prosperity. In fact, Millennium goals and different economic goals, they say we're supposed to eradicate human poverty, extreme global poverty, by 2030. And I know there's a lot of negative things in the news about certain countries, etc., but what is commonly not reported is that only 9% of the world today lives in extreme global poverty. the market has done amazing things. And again, that's right, left, or center. Economic historians do not argue about this. This isn't partisan. But they're saying, and obviously we're going to bracket with the unparalleled prosperity. There's obviously all kinds of social consequences, aren't there? We have consumerism and all the, you know, let's bracket that for a whole nother talk. It's not been all roses and rainbows and unicorns. But that being said, only less than 10% of the world actually, in reality, lives in abject global poverty. Primarily fueled by China and India, and that's a whole different discussion as well. But you have this prosperity that is indeed happening. Life expectancy, nutrition, medicine, etc. It's all off the charts. There is much to be thankful for, to hope in. And Christians have been on the leading edge of some of this entrepreneurial mission work. But what you have to do is actually have a business, a proposition, an idea, an entrepreneurial venture that is actually valid and will work. And so what the Acton Institute does is it comes alongside different organizations. We offer, what does it live like, what does it look like to have a virtuous, human-centered, Christ-oriented understanding of the human person? The Acton Institute starts with a robust theological anthropology with what it means to be human. And then we start talking about economic and political questions. That's what sets us apart from Cato, Heritage, Brookings, etc., these other think tanks that do very similar things to what we do. In fact, we are consistently ranked in the top 10 most impactful social policy think tanks by the leading nonprofit researcher at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're right here in Grand Rapids, 28 years old. So, here's one, the takeaway question I want us to think about before I start meddling. The sentence that I want you to think about, the question I want you to ponder that I hope haunts you and me as we think about the type of missions we do in our local congregations, both here in Grand Rapids, what Justin was encouraging us to do, both statewide, nationwide, and then internationally. Does our intervention, our, O-U-R, does our intervention displace or complement local capacity? The original sentence says, does foreign interaction, but this can be easily placed on the level of local here in Grand Rapids. Does foreign intervention or does our intervention displace or complement local capacity? I could bore you to death with anecdote after anecdote after anecdote of how the modern mission movement in America, good, well-meaning, evangelical, Catholic, Lutheran, no, nobody's immune from this, saying, I see pictures of abject global poverty, so I think we should, really happened in Atlanta, put a 40-foot ocean-going container in our parking lot and fill it full of clothes because we had missionaries show us pictures of semi-naked children. And this church collected a semi, you know what a steel ocean-going container, they cost roughly $25,000 to ship to destination. And they shipped this particular container to Kenya. What is the second most impactful export of Kenya per their GDP? Cotton. Kenyan cotton is widely known to be one of the finest cottons in the world. And a church had a drive. They said, let's give clothes to these naked children. They filled a 40-foot ocean-going container. They raised $25,000 from their loving community, and they sent clothes to a net exporting clothes country. That's a failure. and I could give you 1,000 other anecdotes. We don't want to be that. We don't want to be that. We shouldn't. As Christians, we should. What Acton, when we go and talk with, whether it's a group of urban pastors or professors or practitioners, what we try to encourage people, like C.S. Lewis taught us in his famous sermon, The Weight of Glory, you have never met a mere mortal. There are people pointed towards everlasting horror or everlasting splendor, right? That's in his conclusion of this brilliant 9-page sermon. If you haven't read it, it's a free download. It's a sermon, a rare sermon by C.S. Lewis called The Weight of Glory. And you have never met a mere mortal. So we should figure out how to actually help without hurting. How many of you have heard of that book, When Helping Hurts? Okay, there's 3 or 4 major books in this field. Well, there are dozens now. It's a whole cottage industry deconstructing how Christianity has actually harmed, with their good intentions, many of the countries that they're trying to go and serve. And we should not relish in that. That's what think tanks get to do. I'm a social philosopher. I taught at a university. In fact, the president of Calvin College hired me at Whitworth University. He was the provost at Whitworth in Spokane, Washington. And I taught business and social ethics, ethics and management, nonprofit management. And I had the opportunity to serve and see and poke and prod. And that's what social philosophers do. Remember what they did to Socrates, because he asked too many questions. Here, drink this. And so, unfortunately, sometimes as a church, we don't do a lot of self-reflection that hurts. In fact, the CEO of one of the leading, most influential and virtuous nonprofits called International Justice Mission, you've probably heard of IJM, about 2 years ago, he came out and said, "Look, young people, we don't want your good intentions." I mean, quote unquote. It's easy to want to say, "I want to change the world." He goes, "What you need to do if you want to work for IJM is actually go and get a law degree, or go and get a degree in medicine. Go and get something that you can actually contribute to the work that IJM does, because just, I want to love on the poor actually doesn't hold currency when they're actually trying to do good work in the nations that IJM is working with all throughout the world." Whew, that's provocative. We don't want you to just come with good intentions to change the world. We actually want you to come with something that you can offer to the people. And we get to work in that space. I get to hear anecdotes. I get to travel. And I want to share one story. Maybe two if we have time. But this last fall, I had the opportunity to go to Walla Walla, Washington. And I didn't stutter. Walla Walla Walla. Julie and I raised, 3 of our kids were born in Spokane, Washington. My other daughter was born in L.A. when I was there running an international medical mission agency. We loved Pacific Northwest. And what Central Washington, if you know it, it's all about the fruit. Billions of dollars of fruit come out of Central Washington. Cherries, apples, pears, I mean everything. And I had the privilege of going to a orchard, the largest contiguous orchard in the northern hemisphere, is a part of Broche Orchards, B-R-O-E-T-J-E, Broche Orchards. They have 5,000 contiguous acres along the Snake River, and they're just about 2 miles away. They have another 2,000 acres. If you've ever drank or eaten an apple product from Costco, Apple juice, applesauce, any of those products, you have partaken in Broche Orchards. They have 12, those of you who are in manufacturing or know anything about real estate, they have 12 million square feet of processing space. 12 million square feet. I got the chance to tour a new 250,000 square foot, state-of-the-art, just opening, robotics-led apple processing plant. And over the last, this man, unassuming, I met the founder, and he was a farmer. totally unassuming guy. And he said, when I grew up, I knew I wanted to, I heard a missions moment in my little local church about a missionary from India. And he goes, I knew I loved India from the moment I heard that message. And I wanted to help India. But I also, in the back of my heart, knew I wanted to grow apples as a 12-year-old. How did he fit that together? He bought his first farm. I will spare you the whole story. It is inspiring. But he goes on to create the largest. They own 7% of the orchard market in the Northern Hemisphere. This one orchard. In the last 10 years, they've given away $100 million in profits. $100 million. They concentrate on four countries alone. Which is the first country, do you think? India. But what they've become specialists in is who picks their apples? Who picks their apples? I mean, just say it. Migrant workers. It used to be poor whites. Listening to his historical aperture, what he has seen in his 70 years of working on this orchard is fascinating. It used to be poor migrant whites. And then when NAFTA, he can almost pinpoint it to the day that NAFTA changed their business model. And now they are one of the leading immigration experts because their sole reason for existence is the primarily Latin American migrant worker. And they're experts in all of that. They've had to hire a lawyer. I mean, it's listening to them as Christians saying, I want to serve God, but with a business that serves locally and internationally, their first focus was, how do I serve the worker that's right in front of me? And the way they've built cities and clinics and housing, and I mean, they've put their money where their mouth is. Because if you know anything about Walla Walla, Washington, it's in the middle of nowhere. And believe it or not, you have to drive a half an hour outside of Walla Walla to get to the orchard. So that's the middle of nowhere. And they have such a beautiful business model of caring for the other. But they are now a leader in robotics and cryo engineering of their apples. In fact, when we were there in September, it was just about to start the picking season, and they were just packing and shipping the last of last year's apples. Because they realized migrant workers who work three shifts destroy families. And they said, how do we, as employers of these people, we love our workers, how do we figure out to get only two shifts, but the same amount of revenue and production? And so they pioneered cryogenic freezing of apples. They invested tens of millions of dollars into this. Now it's industry standard. But it started with Brochi Orchard because they said, we love the other. We love the worker for us. And so their money, their management philosophy started right with their employees, but it's now transmitted across the world. I love that. And so I get to go witness that. And there's a home builder down in Lubbock, Texas I visited this last fall as well. They do 1,000 homes a year, 1,000 homes in the Permian Basin in Texas, all that oil production is still pretty hot down there. They've given away $60 million in the last 5 years. With the same, I could give you the same model. So what I want us to encourage us to think about and to provoke and to prod and to push, before I open it up for questions, is that what are we doing that actually helps, that doesn't create toxic charity, another book, that doesn't create dead aid, another book. Those are the three top books I would recommend. If you're honestly interested in this at the popular level, Help When Helping Hurts, Toxic Charity, and Dead Aid. If you want to be provoked, convicted about what we do as Christ Church with our monies, all the way down to our short-term missions trips. Yeah, now I'm meddling. I will argue it's unvirtuous to do anything that a local can do when we go down to short-term mission trips. Whew. No darts yet. It takes an intentional way of viewing the other person. What Acton stands on is the idea in Psalm 8, who am I, as created as a human, to have God think of me. But we know our humanity is something special because it's mentioned both in the sermon, and I'm going to reinforce it that God, Romans 5:8 has been so impactful to me as even a younger child. I tried to wrap my head around, but God demonstrated. And that's wrapped up in the incarnation. But God demonstrated his love towards us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Well, the reason he died for us is because he was one of wrapped up in flesh. The incarnation is something I can't fathom. But what I do know about this is that he is tempted beyond measure for our sake. He can attest to what we have concerns about. The writers of Hebrews tell us this. The human person should be made the subject of their own story, not the object of ours. And Acton lives to promote that sentence. Helping others flourish where they are. And I'll close with this. There's a Ghanaian, brilliant, wealthy woman that we work with a lot from Ghana. And she is off the charts entrepreneurial in how she looks at the world, supporting her country and her continent. And she says, look, don't tell us, teach a man to fish, that phrase. She's like, we're African. We empower. We know how to fish. We need access to the pond. The interdependency, the globalization that has brought unprecedented wealth to the world. We need access. We don't need foreign aid. We don't need the dumping of your clothes. We don't need the ruining of Haiti with rice. You have Bill Clinton in front of the Senate Select Committee on the foreign aid debacle that happened in Haiti, and he had to admit, look, we thought we were doing something good, and they destroyed the economic capacity of the country of Haiti through good intentions. So this is government-led, this is church-led, this problem of not thinking through the consequences of our good ideas is rampant. And we, as a church, should take the virtuous lead and say, I want to support you as the subject of your own story, not the object of mine. Thank you.
Get some questions. Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
does your wife get to ask a question?
Yeah. Oh, geez.
I just had a point of clarification. You were saying that, abject poverty is 9%, largely because of China and India. I'd like you to say positively or negatively, because you didn't make that clear. Are they involved in making people more prosperous or not?
Yeah. She's a sandbagger. She was. I didn't plant her for that. That's a whole other discussion. But there's a major tension and argument whether because some people will point to Africa because they're saying most of the growth happens in China and India because of their economic structure is ramping up so quickly. But then you have Africa, the continent. It's not a country. I hate when people act like Africa's a country. The continent of Africa is largely dragging down the numbers. So people are saying, yes, you can focus on all of these numbers, but let's look at other countries that are having a significant more difficulty bringing a positive growth to their GDP. So yeah, there's a major argument about whether that's good or bad.
Okay, other questions? Yeah.
What are these companies who are giving away a lot of money to foreign foreign nations doing in such a way that they're doing it better than traditional investment?
Yeah, good, thanks. There's a word we borrow at Acton from social teaching, the Catholic social teaching called subsidiarity. blow your mind, subsidiarity. And it essentially means that those who are closest to a problem are best able to handle, understand, and engage the problem. Those who are closest local level. And so, for example, Brochi Orchards only concentrates on four countries. And they have team leaders in their corporate structure at Brochi Orchards that manage one of those. And they have long-term, long-standing engagements. So it's not, they don't, it's not like drive-by evangelism. You probably heard that phrase before, drive-by evangelism. It's not drive-by aid. It's there for the long term. What are the needs of the people? Because Acton promised, we do not have a silver bullet. We don't go in and say, we're going to solve all your problems. Because each country is highly unique. Whether it's what is the corporate structure maybe is unraveling. Maybe it's the political structure that's unraveling. You know, each country has its unique set of problems, just like America does. And so it takes a keen eye to say, what is the actual need long term for the country, not short term. Most of the damage goes off the rails when a government project or a nonprofit project comes in for the short term. And so it's the long-term vision in a short amount of space to actually do good that is the most important. That's where they're seeing the most success. Great question.
Who else? Other questions? What? Yeah.
Just going down the line, eh? You said you're opposed to churches doing short-term missions and things that are very short-term drive-by evangelism. What is your feeling on churches going and doing, you know, a week-long trip, what I've done, a week-long trip in Costa Rica,
sure,
through Young Life?
Yeah.
Helping, you know, a church spending only a short-term missions work with an organization that's planted there and working there. What do you feel about that? And if not that, what do you think the church should do as opposed to these short-term missions?
Yeah, I'd be a millionaire if I had an answer to that question. I'd write a book. No, and it's not just me. And I want, if it came across that I'm opposed to it, I'm not necessarily opposed to short-term missions, as long as we understand short-term missions is more about us than them. Short-term missions is more about us. So I'm not against it. We send a team to Jamaica. Great. Awesome. It's more about us than them. And so I'm not opposed to short-term missions. And again, I didn't invent this antagonism to short-term missions. You will go blind on the literature if you actually want to study this. There is demographic, economic, theological argumentation for the imbalance of short-term missions. So again, in 30 minutes, it's hard. I can be provocative, but then I can just walk away. But since I go here, I would be happy to have long-term conversations with any of you about this. Let's go to coffee. Let's go to breakfast. So I wasn't trying to be provocative intentionally, but short-term missions are important. But I would argue, like your friend next to you said, are you going to a place where there's any kind of relationship? And when I lived in Southern California, and this is true, when I lived in Southern California, Orange County, one of the wealthiest counties in the world, I participated with men that went to a church that their campus was worth $100 million. Their junior high building was $20 million. Many of these churches would commonly go 2.5 hours south, and they would paint homes in the first city they would come to in Mexico. And there are multiple fact-checked anecdotes that the same houses would get painted over and over. And we laugh at that, but we should actually cry about that. Because the unprecedented resource of the American church shouldn't be sent into painting the same home twice. There are other things we can be doing there. We should be going there. I'm not anti-missions. Hear me, please. Missions is at the heart of what Christ called us to do. But doing it virtuously with a mind for the poor, not just a heart for the poor, but a mind for the poor, is infinitesimal. It's more difficult to make that distinction. And so it's that kind of having participation in a short-term mission trip, understanding it's largely about us, not them, but largely saying, are we going somewhere where we're actually doing good and not just doing religious tourism?
Yep.
I have an example for you. About 12 years ago, I went to Kenya, Nairobi, and stayed with Debbie Dortzbach, who was working with AIDS and she still is. And I was a nursing instructor, and so when I went there, I was helping teach home care workers how to care for, you know, homebound AIDS patients who are dying in the slums. And before I went, our church just got kind of crazy about sending AIDS care packages along with me. I had a whole big suitcase full of them. And when we got there, Debbie explained to me, we never want you to actually hand any of those out to anyone. The only way those will ever get to people properly is if it goes through the social worker who has a relationship and a program within the slums with those people. Otherwise, you'll destroy her work. And that was really hard for me to understand at the time, but I get it now. And I think it's a good example of what you're talking about.
Thank you, Pat. Yeah, that's happens more than you know.
Thanks for speaking. I really appreciated your comment about thinking and making distinctions and how important that is. And it seems like the Acton Institute being founded by a Catholic fits because it seems like Catholic social teaching is a lot broader and deeper than anything Protestants have produced. So my question is this. It seems to me that the greatest competition that Christianity has is capitalism these days. And I throw that out for you either to dispute that or to say we at Acton are working against that in this sort of way. What you're saying about virtuous and your other things. But would you comment on that, please?
Sure. It is, I think we've got to land the plane, and so that will save me. But no, this is a sticky wicket. That's a landmine. And what Acton doesn't shy away from is we are a conservative-leaning, free-market think tank. The word we don't use, though, is capitalism. Because it is so rife. Crony capitalism, government in bed with big business, has done more damage than we would like to admit. So that we're pro-free market, but not capitalist, necessarily. And the disjunction, the discontinuity for most people is understanding the connection of virtue and free markets. In fact, Adam Smith, the father of modern economics, theory of more, his book, The Wealth of Nations, most people forget 13 years earlier, his magnum opus was actually his theory of moral sentiment. Adam Smith was a moral philosopher, not an economist. And 13 years prior to The Wealth of Nations, he argued for what he believed human beings are for. And it's this moral sentiment. We have to have virtue as communities, loving like our city, like we heard about. How are we virtuous? And then let's think about the wealth of nations. Because it's out of the seedbed of virtue comes good markets. And that is where Acton is able to walk that fine line. We are nonpartisan, non-political. We lean conservative. Nobody shies away from that. But we do not jump on the capitalism bandwagon. We try to talk about virtuous free markets. So awesome question. Thank you.
Great. I think we're going to have to stop there and let us transition for the next service. This is great, Dan. Thank you very much. Let's show him our appreciation.
Thank you.
Really encourage you to check out that Poverty Inc. Film that they put out. We viewed that when it was still called Poverty Cure, and it's a wonderful series, and you'll see a sample after sample of where businesses are working in other countries as well. All right, you're dismissed.